I want to start with two things that people hold simultaneously without even realizing that there's a tension being created by this. And I think it's worth examining. The first thing they hold is, I've done a lot of work on this, this being whatever they're working on, right? Real work, honest work, sometimes years of it. Therapy, somatic practices, healing containers, self-inquiry. And there's the work is genuine, and they often have real progress. But the second thing is that they hold is, and something is still running. The same pattern surfaces, a different form, but recognizable underneath. And over time, quietly, without a conscious decision, there's an assumption that settles in, which is, this is just how it is. This is what living with trauma means. The goal is to manage it, not to finish it. I want to examine that assumption today, not because it's wrong to take trauma seriously. It isn't. And not because the work people have done doesn't matter, because it has. But because in my clinical experience, the belief that trauma cannot be resolved has itself become one of the biggest obstacles to resolving it. Trauma isn't necessarily a permanent state. For many people, it's an incomplete process. And incomplete processes, when given the right conditions, can be completed. So on this episode of Ask Dr. Gill, we're going to talk about how to complete trauma and what that actually means. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And today on the podcast, let's start by talking about what trauma is, because I think that there's a lot of confusion around this. You know, a lot of people think, oh, something big must have happened, like, you know, a surgery or a car accident. In fact, I've had patients who don't even recognize that a surgery they had when they were 2 years old is actually trauma. Let me start with what I see in clinical practice, and then I'll tell you which frameworks make the most sense of it. In more than two decades of working with people across psychotherapy and naturopathic medicine and somatic approaches, I keep observing something over and over again. The people who are struggling most are rarely the ones who experience the most dramatic events. In fact, oftentimes the events that they experience were really ordinary, something that usually was repeated, though. And the nervous system never really made sense of it. It never was able to process it and let go of it. Most of the trauma I see clinically didn't come from a single catastrophic moment. It arrived Tuesday after Tuesday after Tuesday, as an example. The household that was unpredictable, for example. The parent who was present in body, but absent in attention and spirit. The child who learned to make themselves small because taking up space led to somewhere unpleasant. The teenager who suppressed rage because expressing it wasn't safe. The young adult who learned that any kind of need was dangerous. Children who are hit as punishment and learn that the body's natural response to that, to protest, resistance, surge over anger, had to swallow immediately. That activation happened and it was nowhere to go. That's what I mean by Tuesday after Tuesday. Oftentimes, though, whatever happened wasn't a catastrophic event, right? It wasn't a car crash. It wasn't a surgery. It wasn't mom dying of cancer when they were young. It was an incomplete nervous system process. And let me tell you what makes the most sense of what I'm saying. Two frameworks in particular that I find helpful. First is Peter Levine's work on the incomplete stress response. When the body mobilizes to respond to threat and cannot complete that response, cannot fight, it can't flee, it can't shake, it can't discharge. The activation stays in the system, not as a memory necessarily, although there is evidence that it is staying in the system as a memory, but it's a setting. And we see that, you know, therapists see that where someone just can't sit still, for example. That's what we see with clients who have had this sort of situation. As far as another framework, Bessel van der Kolk's contribution, I think, is really important. The body carries patterns the conscious mind alone cannot fully resolve. The narrative may be settled, but the somatic imprint often isn't. And these are interpretive frameworks, by the way, not settled biological laws. And there's definitely research that points in other directions. But I think the idea behind it is still important, right? Whether it's the body keeps the score or the brain keeps the score, which is what the debate is about right now, I don't think it matters so much in terms of how we treat it. Because in my clinical experience, they make sense. What they are saying makes sense of what I keep seeing. And other models alone don't do that necessarily. Now, what I want to add from my own clinical experience is trauma is not primarily a story about what happened. It's a biological state that is activated and then doesn't get completed. And the nervous system will mobilize, and that mobilization never finds an endpoint. That unfinished charge has been running quietly underneath everything, shaping behavior, it shapes thoughts, it shapes perception, shapes physiology, ever since whatever happened. When I say trauma, I am not talking about the worst thing that ever happened to you. Let me be clear about that, because oftentimes things that happen that are big, we process, right? I'm talking about an experience that activates the nervous system beyond its capacity to process and complete. And then the person never goes back to allow that system to reset itself and to finish. That definition is much broader than how people use the word. And the breath is precisely the point. That doesn't mean everything is equally significant. The magnitude of the event still can matter. What the definition adds is that the body's capacity to complete the process matters just as much. A smaller experience that couldn't be processed fully can leave a more persistent charge than a larger one could. Because here's what follows from this. Almost everyone carries unresolved adaptive responses. Not everyone experiences a catastrophic event. But almost everyone has experienced repeated activations that were suppressed, dismissed, or simply never given the conditions to resolve. Whether you call that trauma or not matters less than whether you recognize the incomplete process behind it. And if you've listened to my podcast for a while, I've talked about this in a similar way in terms of concussion. There's, you know, when I do neurofeedback, I tell people there's no such thing as a mild concussion. Because any concussion can create conditions that change how our brains are operating. Trauma, or these experiences, however you want to call it, function in a similar way, I suspect. You don't have to been through something terrible to carry an incomplete process. You just have to be human. And I want to be clear about what this does and doesn't mean. Saying that incomplete processes are universal is not saying that all experiences are equally significant. They aren't. The severity, duration, and relational context of what someone carries matters enormously for what they need and how long resolution takes. What is universal is the mechanism, not necessarily the magnitude. So trauma isn't a category of experience as much as a category of response, and most of us have more of it than we realize. So I want to say something carefully here, because this section might be misheard. In the last decade, something important happened in how our culture understands trauma. A movement grew that said, trauma is real. Its effects are physiological. People deserve to be believed. And the body holds what the mind can't always process. That movement has done something very, very important. It's improved access to care. It's helped millions of people understand why they respond the way they do. And for many people, the moment they encountered trauma-informed language was the first time that they had a coherent explanation for years of confusion and self-blame. That matters, and I'm not dismissing that. I want to examine a shadow side that has grown alongside it, because shadows grow generally whenever there's light cast, right? And I've sat with people who've been in trauma therapy for decades and still describe themselves as traumatized, not as people who experience trauma, but as traumatized people. This is a shift that I think is subtle but important. When trauma is an experience you are processing, the orientation is forward. You are working towards something, and that is an implicit sense that the work has a destination. When trauma becomes an identity, when it answers the question of who you are, that orientation shifts. Resolution starts to feel like a threat to a self-concept. It's like our healing community becomes the primary place of belonging. The next layer of processing is always available, and the horizon keeps moving. I want to be very careful and precise about what I'm saying. I'm not saying people are attached to suffering. I'm not saying trauma identity is chosen or conscious. For many people, claiming a trauma identity was actually really, really helpful. It was a protective act. It was an acknowledgement that, wow, that was a really messed up situation. And it was the first time that they could name what happened to them and have it recognized. And I absolutely want to validate that and say that is really important. What I'm asking, though, is this. What comes after that? What happens after the recognition is no longer the primary need. Like, you know you are traumatized, and you know you have reactions. Then what? And I'm naming this because I see this in the practice, and I often see how unintentionally we as practitioners can become managers of a permanent condition rather than facilitate a completion of the process. It's not bad faith in most of the time. It's that our framework doesn't include resolution as a realistic destination. And resolution can look like different things. Resolution may be, oh, that's my reaction. Yeah, I know what that is. That's resolution, right? Which brings me to what I think is the most consequential part of this conversation. Many people have stopped oriented towards resolution because they've been told, either directly or indirectly, that it isn't possible. The goal that they've heard is, well, you're going to live with this for the rest of your life, and you'll manage it skillfully. You just don't want to let it run the show. And that framing is appropriate sometimes. There are clinical situations where ongoing management is the honest and actual goal. And naming that clearly is itself a form of care. As I tell some patients, it's like you can recognize what's happened and notice when your nervous system gets activated. And once you're aware of that, you can kind of let things go, right? I mean, that is managing it, right? But for many people, that's not necessarily the full story. And when a person genuinely believes that resolution is off the table, they stop looking for it. The belief often closes the door. And management is important. It stabilizes. Completion resolves what is resolvable. Both matter. The question is, which one are you oriented toward? And whether the orientation was chosen or you just absorbed that. So I'm going to take a quick break. And at the other end of the show, we're going to look at what completion might look like. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back. I'm Dr. Gill, your host. I want to talk about what completion looks like because we've been talking about trauma and how to manage it. And we often don't talk about, like, what does completion look like? How does that look like? Because our brains are wired in a particular way. That's what we've been taught. And you know, it doesn't necessarily change, right? I don't think that's true. And I think that there are things that can be wired and stuck and other things that can be wired and changed. So I want to talk about what I mean by completion, because the word can easily be misheard. Completion does not mean eradication. And that's, I think, an important piece that people need to really recognize. So it does not mean that the event is forgotten or necessarily the wound is gone. It does not mean that you arrive at a state where nothing ever activates you ever again. It doesn't mean that you've wiped the slate clean in terms of your history either. What it tends to mean in my clinical experience is this: the nervous system is no longer organized primarily around the survival mechanism related to that event. A response that used to be automatic becomes less automatic, maybe even is just sort of like, I've seen that before. Activation that becomes proportional rather than overwhelming. I mean, as an example, some of the things that happened to us in childhood were absolutely wrong, and people still act that way, right? And that doesn't mean when they act that way, you're not going to be like, hey, don't do that, right? That's not what we're talking about. You're still going to have boundaries, but your response to that is going to be in proportion to the situation. And the pattern that used to run your life becomes more about information instead of what it is in terms of, like, everything. Let me tell you about a patient. I'll call her Sarah. Sarah came to me with what she called high-functioning anxiety. She had been in therapy for 7 years. She'd understood her patterns with genuine sophistication. She could trace the origins of her hypervigilance to her family environment. She named the attachment disruption. She could connect to her current reactivity. And she had really good insight and had worked really hard. But the hypervigilance was still there. Every morning started with a baseline dread of, what is that? Her relationships were all exhausting, and she was always braced. She would never sit with her back to a door in a room because she wanted to be able to know where the exit was and see who was coming in. The earlier therapy had built insight and language that became essential once the nervous system work began. The foundation mattered. I want to be clear about that. But what it didn't address was the physiological layer underneath. Over the course of about 6 months that addressed the physiological layer first, the nervous system regulation, sleep restoration, biochemical stabilization, and then gradually moved into somatic and relational dimensions, something shifted. It was gradual, but noticeable. She described it this way: I don't know when it changed, but I wake up and it's not the first thing anymore. That is completion. It's not a cure. It's not an absence of history. The nervous system no longer organizes primarily around the threat that isn't there anymore. In my clinical experience, completion tends to happen through one of three overlapping pathways, and the right pathway depends entirely on where the incomplete process lives. Let me walk you through this, and maybe you'll recognize this in yourself. By completion, I mean something specific. The activation becomes proportionate rather than overwhelming. The response that used to be automatic maybe is less automatic. The pattern that used to organize around a daily experience becomes something you observe rather than something you're inside of. It's, like I said, it's not the absence of history. You just have a different relationship to it. So the first pathway is somatic discharge, the body completing what it couldn't complete at the time. Trembling, heat, tears, spontaneous movement. These responses can represent the nervous system moving towards completion. When they emerge within a sufficient safety and container, there can be genuine integration. I want to be specific about this because not all activation is completion. The same responses can also represent overwhelm, reenactment, or dysregulation. The difference is usually in the conditions. Containment, pacing, and a regulated relational presence holding the space. Approaches to that lead to this is somatic experiencing, lens neurofeedback. I definitely have seen this in my practice with that, and certain carefully structured breathwork protocols. What they have in common is working below the narrative level. It's at the level where the activation happens. The second pathway is meaningful meaning integration. Sometimes the incomplete process is not primarily somatic, it's narrative. The event hasn't been placed within a coherent story. Humans are amazing storytellers, and I have a whole discussion about this on my website, where we like to tell ourselves stories. And sometimes those stories are really, really helpful. The person knows what happened, but hasn't found a frame that allows the experience to have a place without requiring it to be good, right? So meaning integration isn't rationalization. It's not everything happens for a reason. It's the genuine work of placing the experience within a larger arc, and one that doesn't require the wound to be erased in order for the person to be intact. That when that happens, something often settles, and not because the pain disappears, but because it has a place. And the third pathway is relational repair. Many incomplete processes in my experience have to do with relationships. Attachment disruptions, chronic misattunement, the experience of not being seen or not being welcome, these happen in relationship, and they tend to require relational conditions to complete, not necessarily and usually not with the original person, because oftentimes the original person doesn't have the skills to work with you, right? It needs to be with a regulated, attuned presence that can receive accurately and repeatedly. The nervous system then begins to update the relational threat map, not through insight, but through accumulating some experiences of something different. This is why the therapeutic relationship is often part of the medicine, and why community containers, spaces offering consistent regulated connection, can shift patterns that years of individual work can't. One important clarification about all three: there's constant overlap. A somatic intervention changes the story you might tell. A meaningful shift changes the autonomic tone. A relational experience changes the physiology. Human beings aren't neatly divided into body, meaning, and relationship. And in terms of the science, it's really hard to look at them necessarily individually, too. The pathways are conceptually distinct, but functionally inseparable. The question is not whether your incomplete process can find completion. For many people, under the right conditions, it can. The question is whether you have the right conditions, the right level of intervention, and the belief that it's worth orienting towards. If completion is possible for many people, why doesn't it happen more often? In my experience, there's four reasons, and they're not equally common, and the most important one tends to receive the least attention. I think one of them is the belief that it's not possible. This is the most consequential obstacle. And I think I wanted, and it's the one most directly addressed by this episode. When a person has genuinely concluded that resolution is not on the table, their orientation shifts from completion to management. That's not a small shift. It changes what they look for in a practitioner and how they define success, how they interpret setbacks, how much activation are they willing to tolerate in service of a process that might actually go somewhere. The belief that resolution is impossible isn't a weakness. It's often the result of having worked hard and not being given the conditions to allow for the completion. It's a reasonable conclusion. But I bring it up as something to examine because sometimes the belief itself is what needs updating to allow for the healing to occur. The next level is the wrong level, meaning integration when the body hasn't discharged the somatic charge. Somatic work when the relational wound is still open. Relational work when the physiology is too dysregulated to tolerate what surfaces. The completion pathway has to match where the incomplete process lives, and the container needs to be able to support that, container being the person. The next level is insufficient safety. This is an interesting one because I've noticed this with some of my patients who don't have a social safety network. Their nervous system cannot complete a stress response because it's still in survival mode. Discharge requires enough biological and relational safety that the system can afford to release what it has been holding. Many people attempt completion work before there's a firm ground. I mean, it's like if you're living in a terrible conditions, you're not going to be able to get into parasympathetic state, for example. It's not that they're wrong. It's just they haven't been given the adequate support. Stabilization in this situation isn't a delay before the real work starts. It's the first part of the completion movement. And the last one is isolation. Many of the completion pathways require another nervous system, a regulated presence, a relational container. Trying to complete trauma alone, particularly if it has something to do with relationships, is like trying to finish a conversation with no one in the room. Sometimes it's helpful to have that conversation, right? To rehearse it, to kind of say what it is that you couldn't say. But in terms of the nervous system work, the process often needs a witness, someone who can hold what surfaces without being destabilized by it. This is not a dependency so much as it's biology. The co-regulatory capacity of a calm, attuned presence is one of the most powerful interventions available and is one of the most underutilized because so much of the available support has moved toward information and self-directed approaches. One quick note on this. I am describing what tends to prevent completion for people who have the physiologic and psychological capacity to do this work. There are presentations, severe dissociative disorders, for example, significant developmental trauma, ongoing exposure to threats, certain neurological conditions where the goal may genuinely be skillful long-term management rather than completion. That is legitimate and sometimes necessary orientation. What I'm arguing against is that the framing being applied by default to everyone before genuine completion has been given a real chance. I have three questions for you to sit with this week. What are you carrying that you've stopped expecting to resolve? Where did the belief that resolution wasn't possible come from? Was it a conclusion you arrived at through your own experience? Or was it something you may have absorbed along the way? And finally, what would you do differently? What would you be willing to enter if you genuinely believed that what your body is holding could be finished? So part of this that I haven't talked about that I just want to say briefly is some of this is cultural in terms of American thought process. Everything needs to be new and shiny, including our psyches and our bodies. And I think that's a piece that doesn't get discussed enough as part of this. And I say that because I want to say you're not damaged goods. You're not an old beat up car. You know, it's you're not permanently defined by what happened to you. You're someone whose nervous system started a process, and under the right conditions, it can resolve itself. The capacity is there. Many nervous systems retain far more adaptive capacity than people have been led to believe. When sufficient safety and support are present, the nervous system often moves towards greater regulation and greater coherence, toward finishing what was started, not because healing is guaranteed, because the potential for it is less fixed than the culture of chronic management suggests. What most people are missing is not the willingness to heal. It's the conditions to make healing possible. And when those conditions are present, when the work is matched to the right level and held in the right context, things change. Sometimes not dramatically. Sometimes it's very gradual, but eventually it becomes noticeable. Sleep starts to restore. Digestion starts to settle. Mornings don't start with a baseline dread. Relationships don't cost as much to engage in. The ability to rest without guilt or vigilance, that's a big one. Emotional bandwidth returns. A response that used to hijack the whole day becomes something you move through in less than an hour. The pattern that used to organize your life becoming something you observe rather than you're inside of. That is what completion looks like. Not the absence of the history, but a different relationship to it. Trauma isn't who you are. It's something your body started and never finished. And when what it has started under the right conditions can be completed. If you haven't taken the quiz yet, check out my website, the Healing Archetype Quiz. It's www.askdrgill.com/archetype-quiz. It's in the show notes if you want to take a look at it. Thanks so much for joining me, and I will see you next time.